I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In case you've forgotten, the Chiefs are Super Bowl champions. But I don't need to remind bettors who watch Kansas City win that in the great state of Missouri, you couldn't place a legal wager on that or any other sporting contest. Today, when that could change and how sports betting might work in the Show Me State. We'll also hear lessons from Iowa, where sports gambling was legalized last year. Then, award-winning jazz vocalist Stacey Kent will be at the Folly Theater this weekend. We'll find out how the New Jersey native went from studying comparative literature to a jazz world tour. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. If you placed a Super Bowl wager in Missouri, it was probably illegal. Turns out that this may be the last time that a Missouri Super Bowl bet is against the law. The odds are that Missouri is in line to pass a sports gambling bill this year that would make the state the 15th to allow for live, legal, single-game sports wagering. Two of those states, by the way, border Missouri, Arkansas, and Iowa, and other states are considering legalization. The U.S. Supreme Court in 2018 ruled that states could open their own sports books. Here to talk about the prospect of legalized betting in Missouri is Wes Ericke. He's president of the Iowa Gaming Association. He joins us from Sonic Factory Studios in Urbandale. He's responsible for 19 commercial casinos in Iowa. Wes, it's nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Also with us is Tim McGrail. He's deputy director of the Missouri Gaming Commission. Tim, nice to have you.
Hey, thanks.
Wes, how much money in Iowa was bet on the Super Bowl last Sunday? Any idea?
Yes, over $6.5 million was wagered on the Super Bowl at 18 of the casino sports books, both in person and on mobile.
In person and on mobile, you're saying?
That's correct. Not all of the casinos have their mobile operations up yet, but the combination of that was $6.5 million that was wagered.
So any sense of how much tax revenue that generated for the good state of Iowa?
Well, the tax rate we have that was put in place when we adopted this was 6.75%. So it was a nominal amount to the state. Since August, though, there's been over $213 million wagered and about $1.4 million that has gone to the state in taxes.
Tim, from the Missouri Gaming Commission, I know from years covering legislatures that predicting what any of them is going to do is fraught with peril. But how do you see things in Missouri right now? How likely is it, from your vantage point, that sports betting is going to pass this year?
Well, we know that there's currently six bills that are out there relating to sports betting. And so they've all gotten through hearings and processes on that. But, you know, it's really hard to distinguish as far as what the legislators are going to do. This is the second year that legislation has been submitted. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what comes out by the end of May.
You know, I know that one of the big issues here, Tim, is what the state tax rate is going to be on wagers in Missouri. One concern is if the tax rate gets too high, people will just blow it off and continue to bet illegally. What is Missouri looking at here?
What we've seen is anywhere from 6.75, which is kind of what you see in like Nevada, up to 9%. So we could see, you know, based on that and based on the revenue that would be generated, that Missouri, the tax could get anywhere between, say, $4 and $9 million.
And Wes, remind us again what you're doing in Iowa.
6.75%. That is, Tim said, that's the same as what it has been in Nevada for all these years. We really try to use that model for low licensing fees and as well as the tax rate to be competitive against the illegal sports operations on the internet, as well as bookmakers and the like that won't pay any taxes.
So what advice would you offer Missouri, Wes, when it comes to the tax rate, the very important tax rate that'll get set here?
The advice I would give is to, you know, try to main to get it equal to like to Nevada's. That'd be the 6.75. If and also look what the licensing fee would be to set up this operation. In our case, it was the 19 casinos that were very unified. We felt that it was best to put it on a casino platform. Certainly the lottery, the horse industry, major leagues all wanted a part of this. And we really emphasize that we've had the best amount of expertise with this in operating a high level of compliance and regulatory environment to give the public the confidence and assurance that it will be handled as best as it can.
So, Wes, explain to me how it works in Iowa then. If I bet $100 on the Chiefs to win the Super Bowl, how is the tax assessed? How does the whole thing work?
So if you wagered $100, you would they'd probably take 10% out. That's kind of the common amount that would is part of you if you won and you bet the Chiefs and won. Congratulations to them. That out of that 6.75% would be taxed for the state. There's also a 0.25% federal excise tax that would come out. And the thing that your listeners need to know and the education that we had last year is that 95%. Of all of the wager goes between the bettors. That's called the handle. And then there's the remaining 5% on average. It's not always the case. Many of our sports books did not do well because so many people in the Midwest here bet on the Chiefs. And contrary to Nevada, where there was like heavy wagering on the 49ers. So it's a volatile, bet. It's different than a lot of others where that whole percentage can range. But on average, it's about 5%. But out of that has to come the state tax, the federal excise tax that's off the handle. Then you have your overhead that includes employees, marketing, operating expenses, and maybe just a very thin net margin, profit margin. And some weekends there's not.
So Wes, if I bet $100 on the Chiefs last week in Iowa, and obviously I won, how much money winds up back in my pocket in addition to my original bet of $100?
Probably about $190. Generally, they encourage
$190 total. Yeah,
totally. So they generally encourage you to do like that 10%, like to bet 110, because then you'd win 210. Back. 200. Back. So then, like, it's like 220. So you always just take about a 10% more on the bet. But if you did only $100, you'd get probably about $90 back in addition to your bet.
Tim, in Missouri, how ready is the Gaming Commission in our state when it comes to overseeing sports wagering, should it come to pass this year?
You know, and Wes was correct. You know, very much similar. Our language is what you see in other states, and so it's going to be reliant on the excursion gambling boats. So you know, we're looking at rules and regulations that have already been adopted in many of the other states, and kind of following suit because again, the language will be very much the same as it would be here in Missouri. So we realize if it did get passed, you know. It would take some time to get the rules established and to be operating, but we would hope that we would do it in a very efficient and timely manner.
What does that mean? Does it mean a few months? Does it mean a year, Tim? What are you talking about?
Well, we hope that it wouldn't be a year, but no, we would hope that within 2 or 3 months that we would at least get the upstart. You know, because a lot of it has already been established, you know, in many other states. So getting the applications in from the casinos as well as from the sports wagering platforms if they decide to go that route as well. So it really wouldn't take as much time as if it was a brand new and starting like some of the other states that have already done. Because, again, a lot of them have followed what, like Nevada and some of the other states have had been going with sports wagering for some time.
You know, Tim, I know that the money that would be generated for the state of Missouri is wholly contingent on what the tax rate winds up being. But again, give us a ballpark of what a sports wagering bill in Missouri, just roughly what it might mean for the state when it comes to added revenue.
Well, they look at the casinos would see and the areas around that, the home dock cities would see as well. So, you know, there would be wagering, but, and again, ours would be both on-site and mobile as well, but it's all the ancillary, the others, you know, where people are going out for entertainment for night, they go out for dinner, you know, or they go out for entertainment as well as doing the sports wagering, the sports betting, either at the casinos or mobile as well.
Hmm. From what I read, the idea of sports gambling has bipartisan support in Missouri, at least in the early going here, Tim. Is that your understanding too?
From what we've seen on the proposed legislation, it is being introduced by both of the parties on it. So I would think that there would be some interest on both sides seeing this the outcome of it.
Any theory as to why there is bipartisan support for sports gambling in Missouri?
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't know. I mean, I think they're looking at constituencies, you know, and they see that as an interest. And we see it, you know, and again, from what the study's shown many times, you know, everyone is, there's age groups, you know, that you see the 21-year-olds through the 30-year-olds, but everyone sees an interest in doing the sports wagering.
Wes, you consider the Iowa sports gambling law to be model legislation. Why is it model legislation?
Because it not only has a very competitive tax rate, the licensing fee is kept low, allows the casinos to have this on their platform as really give the public the most confidence. We have a highly respected Racing and Gaming Commission that put forth the rules and the oversight, like what Tim was talking about for Missouri. We're allowed to bet on all pro and collegiate sports, as well as Olympics, as well as in-state teams. We don't have pro teams here, but with the college teams, and it has that mobile component where you can get yourself registered and not only come into the casino, which has really created a lot of interest. People do enjoy watching sports and wagering on sports, but also then to have their mobile app so the times they can't make it to the casino that they can be out with friends. So we have, it's called geofencing. So anywhere within the state, that app would work within about 60 yards of the border that it would not work. But so that has created a great a piece of legislation. And there was extensive discussions on it. Several bills, like what Tim alluded to, that's in Missouri right now. A lot of transparency, a lot of initiatives. But at the end of the day, they came with what we feel is a model legislation that's working very well for us.
You know, Wes, that's amazing to me what you just said. What you're talking about is the ability to go on your phone and place a bet. And what you're saying is that in the state of Iowa, as would be the case in Missouri, I think, you can place those bets on your phone while you're physically in the state of Iowa. But as soon as you leave, you can't do it any longer. Do I have that right?
That's correct. You can still look at what the various odds might be on a games if you're out of state, but you have to be in the state, the borders, in order to be able to place that bet on a mobile app.
That's amazing. I'm wondering, Wes, what else would you suggest to Missouri as we wrestle with this issue down here? Things that you've picked up from your experience here. What should Missouri lawmakers be thinking about?
There likely could be an effort by the major leagues to want to have royalty fees, and they've tried it in every state. They were not successful in any state, nor in Iowa.
Those are called integrity fees, right?
I think they changed it from royalty to integrity fees, and we made the case that that was never requested in all the years, 25-plus years in Nevada. In fact, that the Nielsen Sports Research showed that the leagues are going to annually gain about $4.2 billion from increased ticket sales, media buys, sponsorships, and more. So that, case was made and was successful, but that's something that you have to have a bill that you start adding on these various fees and taxes, then it just doesn't become competitive. And that's what in order to make this a very low margin business, but it has a great deal of interest, and there's other ways that these, like the leagues, will benefit, and so that was something I would recommend that they look at.
Wes, hang on before you recommend some other ideas for us here. I'm wondering, Tim, is Missouri looking at these so-called integrity fees where you actually give a slice of the revenue to the major sports leagues, or what's being looked at in Missouri?
No, there are. Some of these bills do have, and they actually changed it. It was integrity to royal, at least for here, to royalty fee. So they look at it as more of a royalty fee. But there are some of the bills do have royalty fees included in on those that would go to either the sports governing bodies, being, like, say, the professional sports, or in some cases could go to some of the major colleges, NCAA, the ones that are in the Division I football or basketball. So those are out there. But as Wes alluded, there, and as far as we know, that there is no state as of now that has actually passed any legislation that allows royalty fees.
Yeah, given that, Tim, why would the state of Missouri go that direction then?
I can't answer that. That would be something to talk to either the sponsors of the bill or the representatives and senators that have included that.
Does the Gaming Commission have a recommendation on the whole idea of integrity fees, Tim?
You know, we don't put any as far as either support or we basically go for informational only and provide that information. We do, when the legislation is proposed, we do give them the at least the numbers that we figure that would be impacted by that. So, you know, for say some of the royalty fees that have been out there, you know, it could generate totally for an entire year somewhere between $4 and $5.5 million that would go to those sports governing bodies.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about the prospect of Missouri legalizing sports gambling during the 2020 legislative session now underway in Jeff City. It looks like Kansas might be a year or two away from adopting this kind of language and this kind of law in the state of Kansas. Anything else you might recommend to us, Wes, that Missourians should be considering as they weigh this idea of allowing sports gambling?
The age limit, in our case, it was 21 and over, which is what is required to get into a gaming floor. You know, there's some discussion whether that should be lower, but, you know, that didn't happen. So I think just making it, you know, you got to get people's confidence on this. You got to crawl before you walk, if you will, and being able to have, certainly through our Racing and Gaming Commission, not unlike the Missouri Gaming Commission, they give them the confidence that this is going to be, the rules are going to be set up, and the regulation, the oversight, the standards. All of that, it's really about education and awareness about what a meaningful bill would look like and the proper platform for it to be on. So, again, being on the casino platform, regulated by a highly respected regulator, important, very important to have mobile access anywhere in the state, be able to sign up for that. There's great technology to do that online, being able to include all pro and collegiate events, mm-hmm. including Olympics, and then just your licensing fee, your tax rate being low, and assuring that some of these ancillary types of things that you just were talking about, such as the major leagues and the like, are not included.
Tim, are we talking a 21-year-old age limit in Missouri as well?
They are. It's still at that, and Wes is correct. You know, the rules and regulations that will be established for that, for the companies to ensure that they don't allow 21 people under the age of 21, and also as far as the detection prevention, as far as any type of compulsive gambling. So, you know, similar to what they have for gambling at casinos, you know, there'll be rules and regulations for a self-exclusion
right.
program, you know, because they don't, you know, this is for, you know, their entertainment and such, and not necessarily for people to be spending money that they really shouldn't be. But, you know, so they'll be on target for much of that, and trying to be very much keeping people aware of it, you know, and that, and making sure as far as advertisement that they're not advertising to target minors or
right.
problem gamblers as well.
And Tim, to place a wage in the state of Missouri, you'd have to go to a casino, or you could do it online if you're physically in the state using your phone, right?
It would be very much similar to what we've seen, like Wes, with Iowa and many of the other states. Yep. Sure.
What would be at stake if Missouri doesn't legalize sports gambling here, Tim?
Well, you know, it's a competitive nature, and so I mean, would there be some lost revenue, you know, for the state of Missouri? That would be seen, and like say, seeing what other states are doing, and as you alluded to, you know, Arkansas and Iowa, but you know, is Kansas in the works? I know Tennessee has passed a bill at least for online, so. Could you end up seeing people driving to other states to do their sports? Or the worry is that they would continue to do the betting on these offshore accounts that are out there. And I'm sure, you know, again, that's just lost revenue for everybody.
But in Missouri, Tim, we're talking being able to bet on the NFL, NBA, college sports, what, even horse racing?
Even horse racing. Now, we do not have, you know, that here in the state of Missouri, but it's for individual athletes, you know, for the person. So that's what they would be betting on.
So not horse racing, saying?
No. So yeah. We don't have the paramutual here.
Yeah. What has Missouri learned from other states that have legalized sports gambling, Tim, as you look around the country? What have you picked up?
You know, we realize, I think, as maybe you said, we're very confident on how we handle and regulate as far as gambling here in the state of Missouri since it's been incepted in 1995. This is totally different. There are a lot of terms and acronyms, and like, say, what Wes said, as far as the handle and the hold and the sports wager as far as prop bets. So there's a lot for us to learn, and, you know, you don't go out and find a subject matter expert, you know, out there. So, you know, we're trying to learn through education and training as much as possible. And that's what's going to take, you know, is being able to understand all this as we start to roll it out.
Tim, as you watch legislators wrestle with this, is there one aspect of this legislation that you and your team at the Gaming Commission are watching most closely?
You know, not really. It's basically the whole package. You know, and again, much of the language is what we've seen in other states, which will help us in the long run, because again, we can learn. We've actually even tried to reach out to some of the states and see some of the pitfalls that they've faced or things that they did not weren't aware of or didn't think of. So, you know, we're watching the whole package, really.
Yeah, Wes, just a final point here. Are there new safeguards needed to protect the players from possibly throwing games, or is that already built into the culture of professional sports?
Yeah, the keeping the integrity very high is there. You know, certainly, I think the sports books in Nevada, they started that where they really uncovered some of the scandals. It really wasn't the leagues that did that. It was the sports books, because they have a lot at stake. And there's a lot of focus on that now as more states like Iowa and others are getting involved with that. So I think people could have the confidence that integrity is going to be pretty high. And in our state now, after they got adopted, certainly all the collegiate athletes were, you know, they always have that instruction, you know, that, you know, you could lose your scholarship, you throw a game, you're going to be off the team. And so it's not to say it can't happen, but if it does, the consequences are going to be significant for not only that college and perhaps that, you know, that player and the like. And tied in with that, just going back to that about consumer protections, that was something I overlooked mentioning, but that was very important to have included, and particularly in the mobile app, that if somebody wanted to limit the amount of time they wanted to play, the amount of dollars they wanted to spend, or even if they wanted a time out, that they could have like 3 days where it would not allow your mobile app to work or only a certain amount of dollars to be spent. So there's a lot of consumer protections that a patron can include as a part of this to make sure that it is a fun experience. And betting, you know, the old saying, betting with your head and not over it, and being responsible and accountable.
We're going to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Wes Ehrike, again, president of the Iowa Gaming Association. He joined us from Urbandale, Iowa. Wes, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Tim McRail also joined us, deputy director of the Missouri Gaming Commission. Tim, thanks for your time. We'll be watching closely with a lot of interest here in what might play out.
Nope, I appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
Thanks again.
Thanks.
Coming up, Grammy-nominated jazz vocalist Stacey Kent joins us. We'll learn about her knack for singing in French and Portuguese and the world tour she just returned from. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Can't get enough up to date? I've got just the thing. Go to kcur.org/Kraske and subscribe to Kraske Off Mic. You'll get updates on the shows you missed and a weekly column from yours truly. Sign up now at kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow, I'll hear about the forgotten policies that have kept segregation alive in major cities and learn how today's neighborhoods continue to face racial barriers. The definitive allmusic.com site describes the voice of Stacey Kent as warm and lyrical with a poetic sense for interpreting standards. You're going to hear why Stacey Kent is described as the epitome of jazz sophistication. Not bad for a woman who didn't plan a career in jazz. She graduated from Sarah Lawrence College with a degree in comparative literature. But while studying in London, the jazz bug bit and away she went. The native of South Orange, New Jersey, had a well-developed international following, and she's going to build on her Kansas City following on Saturday night at the Folly Theater, where Stacey will be performing. She has 11 albums out, a Grammy nomination in her pocket, and album sales topping $2 million. Let's listen to Stacey Kent.
Belongs to you, belongs to me, belongs to no one. See the way the cribs and battles scatter when the wind blows. Ah, the secret sigh of love that suddenly the heart knows. See how a robin's there among the puddles and hopping through the misty raindrops. He's come to tell us it is spring. Look at the double rainbow. The rain is silver in the sunlight. A fleeting fox is in the garden. Rain, sweet love and mother rain, that soaks the earth, that swells the streams, that clears the sky and brings the blue.
Stacey Kent, welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have you here.
Very nice to be here. Thank you.
So how did a nice kid from South Orange, New Jersey, who studied comparative literature in college, wind up in the nasty world of jazz, Stacey?
You know, I grew up with a close-knit family of folks who were in more of an academic field. My mother taught, my grandmother taught, and I grew up in that sort of world, surrounded by literature. My mother would have us read aloud to one another every night. I had a bunch of siblings, and we would all share a book. It would be on our lap, and we would read a chapter aloud to one another. And I think I learned very early on that even when I was reading something else aloud that comes from somebody else's voice, say a Charles Dickens novel, mm-hmm. I realized that when I read that chapter, it was in my own voice. I discovered my love of interpreting a story very young, and this was years before I became a singer. But then just to cut and quickly explain how the music fell into my path. Mm-hmm. When I graduated from college and I went to Europe, it's almost like fate stepped in, because I kept meeting musicians. I kept running into people who would ask me to come and sing with them just for the fun of it. I'm really not sure how I ended up on this path, because it wasn't a plan at all. But that's why I sort of became kind of a fatalist, because something put me here.
Sometimes the things that aren't planned out work out the best, right?
Yeah, and I think it leaves you with a great philosophy too, because it leaves me very open-minded. You don't know who you're going to meet around the corner tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a beautiful sense of optimism. You don't know who you're going to meet tomorrow who's going to change your whole life. This has nothing to do with our careers. It's just, you know, the path that we're on in general in life. You meet somebody who becomes a treasured friend or a love or, you know, a lifelong friend. It's just something that happens to us. And I think that having this happened to me so early left me with that philosophy. Hmm. So I enjoy my own story very much of my own life and path.
So when you were deep into the books in college, what were you thinking you were going to do?
I thought I would be on an academic path. I thought I would
just
be
like maybe
a translator.
Yeah.
Well, like my mother, but my mother wasn't a linguist. She was an English only. And because I grew up with a French grandfather in the house with whom I was very close, he taught me how to speak French as a little girl. You know, sometimes that relationship between grandparents and grandkids is so inexplicably mm-hmm. special. Mm-hmm. We were 60 odd years apart, and yet we were super close, and we shared a real vision of the world. That's so crazy to say, because, you know, there I was 5 and he was 65 or 67 even. And yet we had such a common thread. Mm. And so he wanted to keep his love of his previous life in France alive. And so he taught me to speak French as a tiny thing. And I was so good at it because my ears were so good. I was able to just imitate him. I had no idea what I was saying, but I was able to repeat back to him. And he loved poetry. And he would recite his poems to me and I would memorize them. And it gave him so much joy to be back in his own world, his original world. And so I think he gave me a love of language before I had any idea what I was doing. All I was doing was playing with my grandpa, you know? And so I went on to study French and German and Italian and Latin and Portuguese, all because of the path he put me on. Hmm. And so I figured I would do something with that. But I, you know, when you're 20 something years old, you don't necessarily know. I knew I had a set of skills. I didn't quite know what I was going to do with them. I knew I wanted to go to Europe and see if I could work with them in some way. And I went to Europe to continue my studies, and I went to work on my master's. And that's when the music started.
You were in London when you started messing around with jazz. Was there a moment for you, Stacey, when you thought, hey, this singing career thing just sort of might work out?
No. All I was doing was I was in London, and there was a one-year post-grad course at the Guildhall School of Music being offered. I'm not even sure how I saw it. There was just an ad somewhere. I was in Oxford visiting some friends who were on a junior year abroad program from Sarah Lawrence. And I saw this ad and I thought, you know, I could do this. It was so romantic to me. I loved Thomas Hardy. I loved being in England. I thought maybe I'll just stay in London for the year. And it was a post-grad course in music. And I had always studied music. I played the piano and I was in the school shows just like everybody else. And I thought, maybe I'll do this one-year course. They probably won't accept me because I didn't do an undergrad in music, but let's just go see. And I auditioned and they took me. And I was maybe one of 25 students who hadn't had an undergrad degree in music. But the plan was just to do this one-year post-grad course and then come back to the USA and finish my studies. I had already started my master's. That's where I met Jim Tomlinson.
Your husband,
who is still my husband and still very much with me. He's my producer. He writes some of the songs. He does the arrangements. And so I met Jim on this course and we fell in love at first sight. That was it. And so when you ask what I was doing, was I planning a career? No, I was just a girl with a huge crush on a boy.
Huh. Well, watching your career from my perspective, you know, you've had this very steady march forward. At least that's how it seems to me in reading about you. Sometime around 2006, you signed with Blue Note, which remains something of the gold standard of record labels in the jazz world. How affirming was that for you?
Yeah, that was huge for me. And I'll tell you what, I'm really glad that they came along in 2006 as opposed to earlier, because I feel like, you know, this trajectory for me has been, you know, you referred to it, the path has been very steady and really solid. And that made me feel good because I didn't have a background in it. I'm glad that I didn't sort of tumble into success in the first day. I think I would have said to myself, you know, this isn't right. You know, what did I do to deserve this kind of thing? And I think that I worked, I did my graft, we were touring a lot, and I just got a lot of job offers. The word of mouth kept spreading about me, and I was on the radio and I was on TV, and I just kept getting these little offers along the way until I ended up in, you know, at this point, 55 different countries. Right. But when Blue Note came around, they came and saw me open the Paris Jazz Festival in 2006. And at that point, they had Nora Jones on the label. And they were so understanding. It's not like they were looking for their new Nora. They wanted to see people who were just authentic and doing their own thing and had good communication with people. And they came backstage after the gig and they said, you know what, we love what you do and we want you to do it at Blue Note. And so I signed with them.
Wow.
And that was a big moment because I had already made a few records, and they were on a smaller label where I was forced to move at a pace that I didn't really enjoy. I was touring too much, and they wanted records for me, and I was young. So, mm-hmm. you know, you just say yes. And so I was, you know, kind of cranking out records at that point without the kind of space that I wanted to create what I wanted to create. And Blue Note came along, and I had started working with Kazuo Ishiguro, the novelist. He was writing lyrics to the songs that Jim was writing. And I said to Blue Note, they said, could you make an album for us now, you know, in 2006? And it was the first time that I got the courage to stand up and say, listen, I could make you a record now, but look at my tour schedule. It's vast. If you just give me an extra year, if you could put me into next year's schedule, I'll give you the record that you want. And you know what? They just said, yes. Huh. And so they let me and Jim and Ishiguro go away and do our thing. And that was the album that really put me on the map. That's the album that had worldwide range and success. So that was a really good part of my story for me.
Stacey, we're talking about the early part of your career. So talk to me about self-confidence, because I imagine that confidence in what you do as a front and center jazz singer is a quality you simply have got to have. Am I right about that? And how did you navigate that?
You know, I really love that you asked this question, because this is so central. We're all different.
Yes.
And that's what's exciting about the genre that we're in. We come to it on different paths. And so our vision of it is quite different. And, you know, for me, here's how I see it. And you're going to think this is kind of funny, but it works this way for me. When I was a kid, my dad really wanted me to play tennis. And like a lot of kids, I was forced to play tennis. I was a good tennis player. Physically, I was talented, but I didn't have the head for it. I hated the competition, and I suffered through those matches. And I knew that it wasn't the personality type that I am, but I was a musician at heart. I always was. I love sharing music. And I don't just mean my music. I'm the kind of person who, you know, I hear something and I go, hey, listen to this. I want to share it with my friends. I'm inviting people in to hear what I've got. I want to hear what they've got. It's a real sharing communication sort of, it's just a great exchange. When I started to sing, it's not that I had enough confidence or too much confidence. It wasn't even a matter of that. It was that I felt like I was in a realm where I could just do what came very naturally to me, which was to share and to communicate.
What a great feeling that must have been.
Yeah, I think those tennis days kind of fed into that, because I realized that that was so anti my personality, whereas the music was so totally me and who I am. It's not like I was on stage going, hey, look at me. I was saying, come with me on this journey. And that felt so right.
Stacey Kent will be performing at 8:00 Saturday night at the Folly Theater in downtown Kansas City. More information about that on the Folly Theater's website. Let's play some more of Stacey Kent's latest album. This is I Know I Dream, the orchestral sessions. This track, Bullet Train.
Just which hemisphere we're in, and this town outside the window looks like the one that we just passed. They call this the bullet train, but it feels like we're not moving, though I know we must be moving. Yes, I know we must be moving, no, we must be moving, no, we must be moving pretty fast.
That's Stacey Kent, the track Bullet Train from her latest album, I Know I Dream, the orchestral sessions. That is so true about bullet trains. You know you're moving fast, but it doesn't feel like you're moving at all.
Exactly. Yeah. Ishiguro has that. So he's the writer of the lyric, and he makes me travel, you know, just mm-hmm. I'm so transported by those lyrics.
You know, this latest album, I Know I Dream, received a coveted 5-star review from Downbeat, which is the magazine's highest rating for any album. They don't give them out very easily. How did you find out about that?
Well, my label, Sony, sent it to me, and I was thrilled.
I bet you
know,
you were.
I had, yeah, they were the ones who came to me and said, you know, and again, this was like the Blue Note moment. They said, we want to be the ones to make the Stacey Kent orchestral album. And I was completely knocked out, especially these days, because you don't expect a label to want to
proactively reach out and help you out. Yeah.
Exactly, because that was a massive, we were almost 60 people on that record, and they wanted to make it, and I was thrilled. And so, you know, we spent a lot of time constructing those songs to make it work for me and my sensibility and the universe we wanted to create. It's an orchestral record, we're a lot of people, but it's still so intimate. Hmm. And so to see it, you know, I made it. Let's be honest, you know, for me, first and foremost, because it was my dream to make an orchestral record, but for everybody else who was part of it, there was so much love in that studio. My God, all of us were just so thrilled. The arrangers were so beautiful. And
why was that your dream to make an orchestral album, Stacey? I mean, there's a long tradition in jazz, even going back to our own Charlie Parker back in the 50s of doing orchestral albums. Charlie Parker's album, Charlie Parker with Strings, a kind of a seminal record. But why is Symphony behind you? Why does that help?
It's not, I wouldn't trade it and always do symphony. I love playing with my quintet. My mm-hmm. God, they're so amazing. And that's so intimate as well. And so I would want both, but I'm much more attracted to orchestral music, let's say, than I am big band, because it fits the kind of personality that I am. To be wrapped in a blanket of all those strings and the French horns and all that harmony, yet still be able to do what you do at the volume you want to do it and the way in which you want to deliver. It's hard to describe. There's nothing like it.
And I was going to say, your voice has been described as relatively soft and restrained. How concerned were you that the orchestra would simply overpower you?
Well, they don't, because you're working in a studio with mics and mm-hmm. separation, and so you don't have to budge. You know, anybody who listens to orchestral records, like the really famous records of João Gilberto with orchestra, Tom Jobim, Edu Lobo, these people are not belters. You know, these aren't Broadway belters. They're very intimate, one-on-one, kind of in your living room type of singers, and yet they make records with orchestras that are even twice the size of mine, and they're not overpowered because we have studio capacity. And then on stage, when we play it live, it's set up so beautifully, the balance. We've got great engineers who make sure the balance is good, that you get to hear clarity from all those, you know, 50 plus instruments and me and never feel like the singer or any instrument is drowning.
With that many people involved, I can't imagine that you were comfortable starting and stopping a lot as you worked your way through these songs. Was it like once you started, you sort of had to get your way through it?
You know, once you're in it, you're so transported. I'm just floating. I've been floating for about 2 years since we made this record, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And we played this project, and also new songs are being added all the time. So we've done this project in Canada, USA, in Europe, in Asia, down in Brazil. Playing it in Brazil was amazing. Just to meet up with different orchestras, because we're the five of us who travel together, and we meet up with the different orchestras and meet up with a new conductor each time. And you walk into a room, and it's like you're meeting up with old friends, you know. Everybody loves the charts, and you press go and you go, and your feet don't touch the ground for another few hours or a few days, really.
Yeah. Well, let's play another track here from this hugely successful I Know I Dream album. This track is Make It Up.
History of love told every day in songs and books, like some big romantic kitchen filled with way too many cooks. Everyone has got a theory, an opinion or an angle, and they treat them like they're precious diamonds dangling from love me. And I can't tell you why. You'd have thought by now we'd have figured out the reason and the rhyme. You love me, and I love you. And it's been this way so long that if we knew what we were doing, we'd be doing it all wrong. So let's just make it up.
That's Stacey Kent. Stacey, what's tougher, recording with the orchestra or recording with your quintet?
Oh boy, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Each one has its own challenges, and each song does. You know, you're confronted with all sorts of things all the time. So I don't know if I could answer that question straightforwardly.
Yeah.
But to be in the studio with musicians you love, whether you're five,
right,
or six or 55, it's just unbeatable. I love being in the studio. But if you were to ask me if I love being in the studio or live more, I'd have to choose live. I love playing live. I love being on stage and sharing with people who've come to go on that journey with us.
But
there's
nothing
like that.
But you can't control live, though.
No, but, you know, that's right. And that's kind of fun. You know, things can happen. All sorts of things can happen. And the audience loves when those little things happen.
And you like that. I mean, yeah.
Well, it's not like, you know, the guys are fantastic. Everybody's fantastic. It's nothing ever breaks down, you know,
mm-hmm,
what I mean, to,
right,
to an irreparable place. But things can happen, like a light can go, or the peg on a double bass can go, or, you know, any little thing. And that makes it human. And what I do at the heart of everything is something so human. And, you know, in today's crazy world, to be in such a privileged position to go around the world to different countries and share music with people, and find similarities between you, is so human and so beautiful. I feel very, very lucky.
You know, you perform in French, Italian, and German, and a number of years ago, you added Portuguese to your repertoire. I read on your site that you and your husband enrolled in a summer school immersion program to get Portuguese down. Why was it so important to add that language?
Well, actually, just to correct you, I do speak all those languages, but I don't sing in them. I've never sung in German, for example.
Okay.
I mean, I studied it at school. But the Portuguese, when I was at college, I wanted to study Portuguese, and it wasn't offered back then. It's offered now. And so I went back to, I used to spend my summers at Middlebury College. I'm sure a lot of your listeners will have heard of it, because it's a very well-known language program for people who, undergrad and graduate, who want to study language. And they have an immersion course there. And I had already been there. I've spent 10 of my summers there, in French, German, Italian, and then Portuguese. So when Portuguese started to become more seen on curricula, I joined up.
Hmm.
Because it was my dream to speak it. I love the poetry. I love the music. It wasn't really so much a career decision. It was a personal one because, as I said, I was a language student before I was a musician. So once I had the opportunity to do it, I jumped. And Jim wanted to come with me. So we did 3 summers of 7 weeks. So we did a total of 21 classroom weeks. And when you live on Middlebury campus, this might be interesting to people tuning in. If you want to learn a language quickly, it's a great way to do it, because you live with the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
You're in a dorm. You go to class 4 hours a day. Then you spend all afternoon. It doesn't matter what your activity is. You could play chess or play volleyball or go to a cooking course, but it all has to be in that language. You
wow.
sign an oath
wow.
to get there. You're not allowed to speak a word of English for 7 weeks. So you learn quickly. And I'm such an addict. I mean, I really love language study. So I'll go back again. I'm not sure when. But that's where that came in.
Well, Stacey's got a very demanding touring schedule coming up when she's in Kansas City Saturday night. It's the first of, I think, 6 concerts in 8 days, an idea that stresses me out. Let's listen to something that'll calm us down here a little bit. This is Photograph from Stacey Kent's latest album. Stacey, we'll look forward to seeing you 8 o'clock Saturday night at the Folly Theater in downtown Kansas City. Thanks for your time today. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm so excited. Can I just say this is my first time to Kansas City?
Oh, good for you.
It's taken so long, so I'm very excited. Thank you.
We'll look forward to having you.
You and I, we two, alone here in this terrace by the sea. The sun is going down.
Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.
It's time for you to go. The day is done, and shadows stretch their